The story is that he used to have such incredible meetings of people that people would even be having sex in front of the altar, and it was okay because of the energy.
They had sex in front of him, you're saying?
Yeah, right in the middle of this crowd, there'd be some people start having sex right there, and he'd say, "They're in the spirit, don't just leave them alone."
No,
and it, of course, is very much verboten, but under those circumstances.
Well,
so that's Fremenon.
Okay, but you're saying that the two guys, they tried to knock him under the water, and they ran off with his stuff, and he chased him? I didn't get the run.
No, he didn't chase him. He just climbed up the banks and headed toward the path he'd been following on that was now on the other side of the river.
But the other guys ran.
When they saw it, they thought they'd gotten rid of him. And when he comes up there, it just they freak out. So he's got to be magnificent.
Right. So then when they run ahead and tell everybody, so he's greeted for the rest of the way across India.
Yes, with huge crowds. And, of course, because he was singing, then he was singing these songs that eventually... then, of course, more got added over a period of time. So he was very, very famous in India.
Is there a way? Can you spell his name? Maybe he's on Wikipedia.
Premanand.
That's P-R-E-M? Prema.
Yeah.
Anand. A-N-A-N-D. Something like that. Premanand.
Yes.
See if it comes up. Eminent skeptic and rationalist from India. No, he was born in 1930. That wouldn't be him. So
wait a minute. Wait a minute. Born 1930. That sounds like him.
He denounced the India God-man, Satya Sai Baba. I don't think this is...
Go ahead.
His parents were followers of the Theosophical movement. Does that fit?
Possibly.
But it doesn't say anything about his singing. Okay, just...
Say anything about him being a lawyer?
Okay, he was India's leading guru buster. That sounds like U.G. Krishnamurti, the guy that Carr is going to talk about. But Premanand was arrested in 1986 by the police for marching together with 500 volunteers towards Puttapar, a town where the main ashram of the guru is located. He went after Sai Baba.
That was 86.
In 76 he went after.
76. All right, now this was 1960. So he made a tour of the world for peace, and then apparently went back. Anyway, what does it say about his death?
Okay, here's what it says. He was born in 1930. His parents were followers of the Theosophical movement. In the 40s, he quit school to take part in the Quit India movement. With that ended his traditional schooling. During the next 7 years, he spent in newly started Guru Kula, where the brand of education was imparted. Nah, there's nothing about him being a famous singer, so this can't be the guy. If he's singing, doing all these songs, there's nothing about
him. You think
him.
So?
Yeah, he wrote a lot of books. He was a rationalist. He basically was an agent of the West.
Well.
Okay, so anyways, it's probably, but Premanand, P-R-E-M-A-N-A-N-D. That's what came up. Is that the spelling?
I think so. And there isn't any other spelling, is there, that works?
No. Okay, we'll leave that. So anyways, that's the guy. Now, I want to go back to Ramakrishna. It says, he was considered an avatar, and then the Wikipedia says, though recent academic scholarship has concentrated on, among other things, aspects of his sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ramakrishna Mission and other scholars have criticized the work of these scholars. So... He's being...
of course.
Yeah, he's being reinvestigated. They're looking into him. So he's being studied, the veracity of it, I guess, of what he was.
Well, actually, he was just a poor little Indian boy trying to get along, especially when he was having his...
epileptic fits.
Epileptic fits, and the fact that he'd come out and talk, and then somebody would write it down and then translate it into Hindi...
Right.
And then he became famous, and a huge amount of India didn't even know that he couldn't speak Hindi.
Right. So he, well, it says he became a guru to anglicized Bengalis, including the future Swami Vivekananda. What's interesting is Bharati, he studied under the in the Ramakrishna world and Vivekananda. He did both of them. Mm-hmm. He says Ramakrishna and Vivekananda were my gurus when he was in Europe. So he was reading them. But when I got to India and joined the mission, in due course, I was compelled to abandon them.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I said.
Yeah. So there was that? Okay. So he becomes... So Bob Carr really likes this guy because he's critical.
Oh, yeah, we liked him. I mean, Connie loved him. He loved Augie. They really had kibitz. We all did, you know. And
but he was teaching you guys something new, which, again, something...
Also, one thing that he did at the center, and this is before acid, we were looking into semantics. Now, semantics ordinarily does not apply to philosophy and religion before that time.
Yeah.
And he taught a class, 16 hours of tapes at high speed. He was so rapid and covered so much territory in that 16 hours that we'd have a two-hour session with him. And then there'd be at least a dozen or two dozen people that would come and listen to it again and again and again before the next class in order to try to get what he had said, because it was so comprehensive. And it was an amazing class. And as he said, well, this is the first time in the world that somebody has taught a semantics class in relation to philosophy and religion.
Happened at the center.
That happened at the center.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So I'm going to read you... the official biography, I don't know why it's the Minnesota State University, but anyways, here's what they say about him. He's born in 1923, so he's 5 years older than you.
Mm-hmm.
He's born on Hitler's birthday, April 20th. He was born in Vienna. It says his parents' names were Hans and Margaret Fischer. Leopold Fischer spent his childhood in Vienna, where he learned how to speak Hindi and began his studies of classical Sanskrit.
Now, the way that happened is that he was going to Catholic school, you know, because everybody had to.
Yeah.
But there were so many... See, Vienna at that time was the medical capital of the world.
Yeah.
And there were so many Indian students studying medicine to become doctors and were doctors that in the... fancy house that his folks had, because his father was so well connected that he taught the King of England how to play polo.
Hmm.
He was so anyway, and he was extremely wealthy because he was the sugar baron. In other words, he controlled all the sugar that came into Vienna, and they loved sugar.
Hmm.
But they had this. Big setup. I don't know if it was a castle or a big house, but where all these parties would occur, and he would meet all these people, and they would talk to him about, because he was a curious kid. So he went to school when he was 9 years old and was spouting off about this, and he got expelled because of it. And then he had to be careful, and he got back in school. And then when he was in his teens, he was drafted into the Hitler Youth. And he said, I didn't think very much about the Hitler Youth as anything, because it was just like the same way as the same kind of rules and controls and authoritarianism as the Catholic Church. He said, so I just felt like I'd switched over to this.
Mm.
And so he became fairly high in the Hitler Youth, but he was learning Hindi and all the rest of it. Well, at one point, the English the Germans had captured 25,000 Indians in North Africa that were fighting with the English. And they didn't have anybody who spoke Hindi. And so what they did is they drafted him into the army and gave him a rank, and I'm not sure what rank it was. But when he went down to North Africa and he met all these Hindis, he loved it. He'd go down and he'd talk to him, and of course the German officers were furious with him, and finally they kicked him out and made him live down there with them. And in the meantime, they get captured by the English again. You see, the Germans had captured them from the English, and then the English come in and capture them again. And so he's arrested with all these
Hindis,
and they decide he's one of the six people that's doing a Free India movement.
Free India movement, right.
Yeah, Nehru and all these others that were involved.
Yeah.
And so they think because he's with them and he knows all this, they think that they don't know that he's Austrian. Because he just figured he's got a ticket out by going with these guys that they're going to let him go, and he'll get out too. The only thing is, they decide he's a part of the Free India movement, and they throw him into jail.
Wow.
Into solitary confinement. And he's in solitary confinement for 6 months.
Is this during the war?
Yeah, or right after.
Okay.
Anyway, he has a routine where he does his ablutions and he does his first step. And then he performs opera for 2 hours, about midday. And then spends the afternoon writing. And finally, they figure out that he is George Fisher from Austria, well-connected, and they set him free, and he takes this book that he's written, which was called The Psychology of Humor, and it becomes a bestseller in Europe. And one of the things about that is when I was talking to him, he says the thing about humor is that you tell a story that follows a line out to a certain point, and then the punchline is way over here. And when you get it, you make that jump, and you giggle. He says, this is a spiritual jump. So the psychology of humor is that you lay it out and give a spiritual jump, and everybody loves it. That was his book.
And if he did that right after the war, he's only in his 20s.
Probably.
So he's a brilliant guy, you know.
Oh, you mentioned the 17 languages. By the time he got to America, he spoke 31. And then while he was in and out of the center, he was studying 8 or 9 American Indian languages, and he found one that almost exactly matched the language in Kerala at the south of India. He said, it's absolutely amazing, you know. Here, they speak this way. They speak this way in their world's mind.
You're miming just the way he was. Right?
Well, saying. Yeah.
You remember him saying that to you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I was the only one, but I remember being there and he said it, yeah.
He goes, it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's very interesting what you say in light of this official biography. It says, I wanted to ask you, what did he do when he was 9 years old, got him in trouble? Was he learning Hindi that early, or just...
Yeah, he was learning about the Indian, about Hinduism and so on, and the language from all these doctors that were guests at the home of his parents.
Right.
At parties.
And the people were guests. His parents were into India? Why were they?
No, they weren't. He was.
Right.
They just were giving a party, and all these students from all over the world were coming and partaking.
And is there any reason why they would go to this rich person's parties?
Well, they were socialites, all of them.
Oh, okay.
You know, that, I mean, it's strata stuff, you know.
Yeah, so what is it? So here's Barati as a young kid. He's precocious. He's talking way beyond the level of a 9-year-old to the other 9-year-olds, and the nuns and that get upset about it, right?
Oh, yeah. Especially when he's talking about Hinduism as being superior to
That's pretty neat. Okay, so it says he spent his childhood in Vienna, where he learned how to speak Hindi and began his studies of classical Sanskrit. Then it says he became a member of Hitler's Free India Legion during World War II and was often mistaken as a real Indian by his own and opponents alike.
Right.
So that confirms exactly what you said.
But does it say anything more?
Oh, yeah. It says his expeditions during war gave him a taste for traveling, and his desire to travel brought him to India.
Oh, I see. They jumped over that whole thing.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. It says where he became a novice in a Hindu monastery.
And that was the Ramakrishna.
Yeah, he says, in time, he was consecrated by the Dasanami Sannyasi order of Hindu monks. Would that be the
Shankaracharya, probably, a section, because there was... I'm not sure. You'd have to look up Shankaracharya and see what they had as sub-actions.
Right, it says he was on the bank...
See, Shankaracharya was the most exclusive, highest Hindu...
It's like Harvard of Hinduism, you know, or Princeton.
Yeah, or the ones all around the Pope, you know?
the cardinals. It was on the banks of the Ganges between funeral pyres that he was donned the ochre robe. You laugh because you remember that? You mean?
Go ahead.
Well, why'd you laugh at that point? It was on the banks.
See what else they say.
Well, they moved to another fact, but it says it was on the banks of Ganges between funeral pyres that he was donned the ochre robe. Now a monk, Leopold Fischer, changed his name to Agahananda Barati.
Homeless bliss.
Yeah, next he started a journey across the 1,500 miles of India on foot as a mendicant monk with a beggar's bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you just said the bliss. Is that the name of a book or something by him?
That's his name.
Oh, Agahananda
Barati means homeless bliss.
and he gets this before he's made homeless. No, maybe after he got home. When he was kicked out, he changed.
Well, I think it's after he got kicked out and then kicked up. Why?
because they say now he was donned the ochre robe, now a monk, he changed his name. And then he started a journey across. So he knew.
Well, now whether there was a step in there they left out. He got the ochre robe, but maybe he got the ochre robe after the Himalayan trip where the encounter was, where they argued all night long, and then had him come and talk, and they said, all right, and then they argued all day long.
But the important, for those listening and think we're going on about this guy changed the West's awareness.
Absolutely.
This guy's an important guy.
He's extremely important because, as I told you, he brought the Dalai Lama's brother over, and he brought 70 Tibetans over.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
They never would have been here.
Yeah, that before, and that's right. You know, in 59 is when China invades Tibet. So we're talking 58, 59. That's when they've left Tibet, and the Dalai Lama is now in India.
So these all left before the problem.
Ah, okay. And you would say that would be in 57, 58 in your memory. When
about 58, in other words, 57... He was already at the center before acid. And then when we got acid, supposedly he and the Dalai Lama's brother had tantric sex with their shaktis on acid.
And came
and gave a report on it, which was very fabulous. You're really mad.
I missed what you... Did you say he really... What did you say? He really mad? What did you say?
No, really mad.
really mad. It's worth it. Let me say this. You're going to say something, right? But I just want to... I remember you saying that you had sex on acid with the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama and his lover
I was leaving that out.
Okay, the brother, the Dalai Lama's brother and his lover were having sex. You and Vern were having sex, and maybe Bob and Connie were having sex, all on acid. Is that what you, is that
well,
the question you're talking
that's,
about? That's confidential? That's for...
That's a footnote.
In other words, you told the story without putting yourself in there. Just now, just a minute ago. You didn't include yourself.
Well, I've done it before, though. But, I mean, as far... The feature was Agayananda Bharati and the Dalai Lama's brother. And my... I remember talking to somebody about this once, and they said something derogatory about it in such a way that that I was increasing my significance by this or something. So in the process of decreasing my significance in this thing, I left it out. there's a lot of things in my life. I mean, it's Bob does it too, but there's a lot of things in my life.
You mean Bob Carr? Bob Carr does it too.
This thing of holding things close to his chest.
And, yeah.
And in some cases, I had reason to keep things tight for a very long time, and I got used to it, so I kept... And it turns out to be probably something that saved my life many times, because there... You know, there's a couple of times I've had people come to kill me. Because of what I was doing.
In the cosmic awareness phase.
Yeah, and then they'd find, no, you're not the one.
Mm.
But they told me what they had. I said, oh, my God. they were looking for Doobie, but Doobie was already dead. In other words, they had read the Cosmic Awareness Speaks, which was mostly attributable to Doobie.
Yeah,
and
the
something in there... Huh? The little booklet, yeah. And something in there set somebody off, and they came. They pretended to be there to watch the readings and stuff, but then apparently the readings were so high and et cetera, and then with a little dialogue. And so, anyway, that's a whole other story.
So are you saying, for the record, that Bharati and the Dalai Lama, his brother, had sex? On acid. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but not with each other that I know of.
Oh, okay. They each had their own lovers, and you were there.
Shakti, they called them.
Shakti. And were you there?
We were, I think, in the same house. In other words, it was at the center. I think they were up on the top floor, and I think, I don't know where we were.
Well, was Bharati gay?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. He had a woman lover there, you're thinking, on acid.
Yeah.
Okay. And the Dalai Lama was gay. He had his own lover, right? Or in that time he was gay. That's what you're saying.
Well, I don't know. I've heard, but I think he had a Shakti now. I didn't check the equipment. I didn't. It was like I knew what was happening, but I wasn't intruding, and they weren't intruding. In other words, it just was a powerful energy that was going on. And
you were on acid, too.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and you and Vern were together.
Yes.
But the thing is, what happened to the Dalai Lama's brother? Who is he? Is he connected to the Dalai Lama today, still alive? Is he part of his movement?
I don't know.
Okay, well, that's a side thing. So let's continue.
Well, he was the head of all the Tibetans that were... There, I remember one thing that was a spinoff from it, is that the art museum in Volunteer Park, was the art museum, now it's the Asian Art Museum, but it was the art museum.
In Seattle.
And they had an expose of all these Tibetan art. And I remember in one of them there is a depiction of a guy with a hard on in yoga position with a cock going up his ass with somebody behind him. he's sitting on a cock while he's got a hard on, and I thought, oh, this is official Tibetan art. Yeah.
Indeed. Okay, so the okay, back to okay, this review of Vagnanandi Bharati's life. Okay, so he goes off, travels 1,500 miles. Although he attended the University of Vienna, Bharati kept up his studies as a monk and took up teaching as well. Bharati's travels were as extensive as his teachings were impressive. He was a professional expert in cultural anthropology, South Asian studies, linguistics, there's your semantics, and comparative philosophy. Most of these subjects he taught in Delhi University, Banaras Hindu University, and Nalanda Institute in India. So that would have to be in the 40s and early 50s, right?
Let's see.
Yes, before he
got... Now, wait just a minute. Let me backtrack. When he was in Victoria, he had just come from Japan. And he'd been there only for a short period of time, but had done some teaching there.
Yeah, they mentioned that. Listen to this. He taught in a Buddhist academy in Bangkok, Thailand, where he first began his teachings on comparative religion.
That's when he escaped Benares.
Yeah, Bharati became a visiting professor on Indian philosophy in the University of Tokyo and Kyoto.
Yeah, but also he stopped in the Saigon. Does it say anything about Saigon?
Not yet. I don't see that. No.
His next stop after Thailand was Saigon, and from Saigon, I think he went to Tokyo, and from Tokyo, I think he went to Victoria, and from Victoria, he went to the Center of Integration.
Yeah, he said, you can stop, it says that, but just want to ask you, so the Banaras Hindu University, that may be the place where he had to run from with the riots and all that. Okay. Okay, so the next sentence after the University of Tokyo, like you said, he came from Japan. In 1956, Bharati came to the U.S. as a research associate for Washington University.
For what?
For Washington University.
University of Washington.
Yeah, so they've got this little...
They say that was in 56?
Yeah, but that's probably the end. You do the acid in the spring of 57.
I could hardly believe that it would be...
It'd be late 56, just after you got there.
It could. That's pushing it back further than I thought. That actually helps make some other things more sense to me.
Yeah.
Because when I've referred to when I first took acid, the thing in talking about this, I have tightened it up. Obviously, after Benares, Benares, Agayananda Bharati, arrived, and the opening of the restaurant, because it was right after we had opened the restaurant, that I had the invitation for my first session.
And
so,
that's
okay,
in the spring of 57.
That helps me settle with myself something, because I would sometimes think, I wonder if it was 57 or if it was later.
Yeah.
And then I'd think, 3 years, well... If it was later, it wouldn't be 3 years, so I didn't then try to zigzag it back. But now, this is very good. It's very good, you know, this thing of after all these years.
Yes. We go
well, because it was so fucking far out that it was hard to keep track of time and place and energies on this plane and the other plane, too, and et cetera, and function day to day, year after year. where did it begin? Where did it end?
300 acid trips. Yeah. And that's Sandoz acid, people. That's the real acid.
Yeah, but I was very lucky in that after probably one-third of those sessions, I started taking less and less until finally I didn't have to take any. All I had to do was move into a room where people had it and just spin around, and I'd be right in a full-blown acid session, and they thought I'd appeared out of nowhere. I used to do it as a trick. Go, there'd be four or five people on acid, and I'd walk I'd walk toward the center of the room and just do a spin and then plant my foot down. And they thought I had planted it.
UFO. It just manifested.
Oh, yeah, there's stories.
Okay, but what's interesting, let's assume this is correct. In 1956, Baradi came to the U.S. as a research associate for Washington University. They're skipping over the whole reason he ends up as a research associate is through the center because Bob found him in Victoria visiting his mother. You know.
Yeah, and that probably was late 1956. And as I said, the first week he was there was phenomenal. The Times did their number, and then the faculty meeting, and then the announcement of, and so that could have been in the very last part of 1956.
It makes sense because he's writing. Bob's writing about this right after Connie moves in, which is around the same time that you're showing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he moves in before you, then you come in. But that's when he goes to Victoria and meets and brings Baradi back. See? It's all the end of 1956.
Yeah. I really thought it was later, but it's very interesting that there's like two or three different jolts that say it was late 1956.
Yeah, and now the interesting thing, you did say that he went to Syracuse, and they verify this. It says a year later. He was only there in Seattle for a year. A year later, he transferred to Syracuse and joined the anthropology faculty. He now goes into anthropology.
Yes.
And did you keep in touch with him in any way after that?
No, I just hear occasionally about him.
Well, this is what you would hear. He'd be very successful. He said he settled down in Syracuse and became Ford Maxwell Professor of South Asian Studies.
He what?
He became Ford Maxwell Professor of South Asian Studies.
Oh.
And it wasn't long before he became the chairman of his department.
Mm-hmm.
He was granted U.S. citizenship in 1968.
Really?
Yeah. Although he lived in Syracuse, that didn't mean that he stopped traveling. He managed to go to Hawaii, Britain, Michigan, Russia, Germany, and Ireland for research and as a visiting professor.
Uh-huh.
So then they list this. Listen to this. He became a member of numerous organizations, including the American Association of University Professors, the American Anthropological Association. He was a fellow. That's probably a certain status. He was a fellow of the Association for Applied Anthropology, the American Linguistic Society, International Association for General Semantics.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be Korzybski?
Yes, and that's what he was teaching us.
Oh, so he brought Korzybski to your awareness.
Well, I don't remember whether I already looked at it, but definitely by that time, yes.
He was a member of Mensa International. That means he was a genius.
Yeah.
Now listen to this. He was a member of the Mind Association. I wonder what that was. Mind, M-I-N-D, Mind Association.
Uh-huh.
That sounds like a little layover from the acid.
It's an anachronism for some other. Maybe it has to do with Mensa, starting with an M.
Right. He was a member of the Royal Anthropological Institute of Great Britain and Ireland. He was a member of the Royal Philosophical Society. He was a member of the Royal Siam Society. He was a member of the International Academy of Human Rights and New York Academy of Sciences. Incredible. I mean, the guy was everywhere.
And yes.
Now... he died in 1991.
And of what?
In a friend's house in Pittsburgh, New York. He died of cancer at the age of 68.
At the age of 68, he died of cancer. Cancer,
yes.
Of what?
Doesn't say. There's a New York Times thing on him, but I don't know if I can pull that up. It says, it references, it says, New York Times, a monk, the obituary. There's a monk who served on Syracuse faculty, is how the New York Times calls him. But, so here you, I mean, he's 5 years older than you, and you're here 17 years later, after he's gone.
See how you are?
Yeah.
There's a long list.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I think in a lot of cases, a lot of my ability to let myself be revelatory about some things is after they die, I feel free. You know, I mean, I don't like to lay something out there that makes waves and comes back on somebody's life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I have tried to make it so that there wouldn't be too much of that come back on me, and I became so good at it that I think that whatever was going on that I didn't care to participate in. I withdrew from, didn't think about, and moved on, and et cetera, and it just quieted down and disappeared mostly. But here we're going to have stuff popping up, and I have to be prepared for that. As a matter of fact, I was so concerned about it, I didn't know whether to do it because...
You mean if you mean to do this interview?
Yes, these interviews amount of energy that I might have to deal with because of it.
Yeah.
Because
you're sensitive and you pick it up. You have a response.
Well, it's like if people project, you know, it's like you did something, you read something about somebody projecting over people's lives and et cetera. Bob was talking about when people projected over him and he had to comply with it or tried that sort of thing. Paul and I were having a discussion about that the other night, and he's dealing with it in present time, where he says that he's had to confront with him and say, look, you stop your projecting over me, because I've got my life, and I'm not going to have all of you projecting over me to do this, that, and the other. He gave this rousing statement to me just the other day.
But
there we are.
Yeah, you're saying that you feel that you said it's revelatory. It's good. It's good that he's dead. Baratti's dead.
Not that he's good. It's not that any good comes out of anybody being dead, but that I can be fairly free with my comments, because who's it going to hurt, except possibly me if there's somebody that does get upset, but. But I don't care, you know. In other words, if they think I care, I'm not saying this stuff from emotional caring. It's from reporting the facts and the experience as I experienced it.
Yeah, and the blackout history. But we did.
Well, that has never been released.
That's right. It's all new. So you didn't know that he had died. You assumed maybe he died, but you didn't.
I heard he had died some time ago, but I didn't know when.
Okay. So it ends saying, in his life, Agananda Baratti was a warrior, a monk, a student, a teacher, an author, and a traveler. By the time of his death, he had published over 500 works.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But a lot of them were probably research.
Yeah, yeah. Academic monographs or something.
Uh-huh.
But it says, including an autobiography called The Ochre Robe.
Yeah, which was published before he ever came to see us. And when his mother read it, when she got to page 38, she, what do they call it when you don't get your fortune anymore? She cut him out of her will?
Oh, yeah. You...
What is the phrase for it? She cut him out of,
She
disinherited him.
Right, and that happened, so he had no more money after that. I mean,
well, he had money that he made himself, but he did no longer have... I don't know whether his mother changed his mind later or not. It's possible.
But she was shocked at the book.
Oh, when she got to page 38, she disinherited me.
Well,
what was on page 38? It was his way of saying, when he asked them about sex and they wouldn't tell him, and he had to look around to find out for himself, especially after he noticed that his father was leaving at 10 o'clock every night to mail a letter and coming in at 6 in the morning. In the meantime, his mother was having a trip with her lover in her bedroom. And he says, and they wouldn't talk to me about sex. And that's in that book to some extent.
You think that's what was on page 38?
Yeah.
Now, okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. We're just turning into a good interview, Dave. You're telling some good stories here. Okay. Just joking, Dave. Just joking. Maybe I'm not joking. I don't know. Anyways, this is good stuff. I had no...
Yeah, it is. It's been a good life.
Yeah.
And it's all true. The only phrase that used to have is, It's all true. We live after death.
Wait a minute, what'd you say? The phrase
it's
was...
all true. We live after death. Somebody said that after some kind of a medium game something.
That was their insight, their epiphany.
Yeah, but they were saying it with a straight face.
It's some all of true.
Us were
we
roaring with
death.
Laughter.
Okay, so he discusses how Agananda gets the job. And then he says, I had a number of discussions with Agananda about Krishnamurti, and he and Agananda could find no real issue to attack. I don't know if Agananda knew who Krishnamurti was at that point. Do you think he did?
I think he did.
Okay. I believe Agananda felt a deep divide within the traditions of Hindu thought, that yoga or some form of practice did create some kind of experiences, not to be taken as real or some superconscious state of knowing reality, but a pleasant experience to be enjoyed, like sex or any other sense of joy that gave one a mystical feeling of being part of the all-knowing ground of being. All-knowing, capitalized.
Yeah, now he did...
You're talking about Bharati.
Bharati did have an attitude about a lot of the stuff, but he had a reverence to, and he definitely was a researcher, and he could report the details of what it was that was involved, whether he agreed with them or not. He might make an aside now and then.
Right.
But sometimes he could go through very straight for quite a while, and it would be very serious. And it's like that one where he was talking on Buddhism, and the woman says, well, you must be a Buddhist. He says, no, I'm not a Buddhist. She says, but you explain it so well, you have to be a Buddhist. He says, no, I'm intellectually a Buddhist, but emotionally I'm a Hindu, because it emotionally satisfies me more. And he would give this look, you know.
Yeah.
Having to do with his shaktis.
Yeah, and he, the interesting thing is that he goes into anthropology. You know, I mean, this is anthropology for him, his comparative religion study.
In a way, he was a walking anthropological resource.
Yeah.
That he could go into, I'm imagining that he could go into any anthropological meeting, and if it was an area where he had looked at all, he could probably be a greater resource than anyone else or any books they had. That's why they would keep hiring him to update them.
Right. Now, he's mentioned in Wikipedia. They have a short entry, and it says that the name Bharati was the monastic name of Leopold Fisher, professor of anthropology at Syracuse University for over 30 years. He was a respected academic Sanskritist. Sanskritist, uh-huh. A prolific writer on religious subjects and a Hindu monk in the Dasanami Sannyasi order. Then it lists his books, 1960, The Tantric Tradition. 1966, The Tantric Tradition in London. And then he did a book in 1976 called The Light at the Center, Context and Pretext of Modern Mysticism. That probably goes into the Ramakrishna history, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then his ochre robe was second revised edition, 1980.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he updated it or something. Brief academic... At the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs, you know, it's Daniel Moynihan, they have a brief academic biography of him.
Uh-huh.
They have a picture of him. Hey, there he is with the Dalai Lama.
And, yes.
And the Dalai Lama's a little guy compared to... Bharati.
Yeah, how old does the Dalai Lama look?
It looks like, he died in 91, so I'd say this is an 80s picture.
As far as the Dalai Lama, how old does the Dalai Lama look?
He looks like, I'm saying this is in the, since Bharati dies in 91, the picture has to be before then, I would say...
Hold on just a minute.
Okay, David, I looked up another biography, and what's interesting, Bharati received the name Aghanand Bharati in 1951 when he was ordained in the Dasani Sannyasi order of Hindu monks. So that's 1951. He's born in 1923, so he's 28 years old,
mm-hmm.
which is like your 28, your 7-year cycle.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you did your 28 thing in 1956. You were 28.
That's right.
And so he, being 5 years older, he did his 28-year cycle in 51. But what's interesting, they say that he is recognized as one of the leading pioneers in the field of tantric studies.
Yeah.
And we're talking about acid and tantric.
And that's what, when he came to the center and then got that trip at UW, that was his deciding factor of coming there, is they would let him translate the Buddhist tantric tradition into, as part of research, and they said, okay, you can do that, but we want you to teach this class over here.
Right. Now, is tantric studies meaning sex, tantric form of sex, or is it
a
broader thing?
Well, see, tantric is gosh, really, darling. the short version is tantric was the original yoga.
And what is the tantric yoga? Is it sex?
It's using the senses to reach God consciousness.
And that's
which is the antipathy of what you hear yoga. And so what happened is when they made it not politically correct, there were all these different segments of tantric yoga that could be separated out and used separately that were different kinds of yoga, but because they weren't linked up to use the senses to reach God consciousness, they were to raise the consciousness, So the joke, cosmic joke is that all these yogas, practices are a byproduct of Tantra, but they don't feature Tantra.
And Tantra, when you say it involves the senses, it's not limited to the act of sex.
No, that's true. As a matter of fact, here's my shorthand version, is if I truly have a Tantric sexual experience with someone, the reason that it happens is that most people, when they have sex, are really using the other body to do their own version of a masturbation.
Yeah.
That the rhythm and the tuning in to the other, it's like it's your nervous system is being bathed by the action. Their nervous system is being bathed by the action. You have certain things that happen while you're both doing it, and so you think you're really doing it together. But if you use the technique of never ejaculating, but being right on the edge of it for hours and hours, and you reach up to a certain level of ecstatic meditation, which includes the sex, there is a crossover point from nervous system to nervous system, which is spiritual because it's at another level, and so that the cycling of energy goes through the other person to you and up, and it's swirling through both nervous systems at perfect simultaneousness. See, now the concept of simultaneousness with some people is that if you hear somebody speak, you hear them. But actually, it takes milliseconds of the sound to even reach your ear and to travel to your brain and have that registry. So that is not really an experience that is simultaneous. At the height of the Tantra experience, because both nervous systems are tuned in with the spiritual top as the connector over, and so that you truly are together. And quite frankly, a state of communication occurs at such a point that never leaves. In other words, you could have a tantric session with one person one time, and you are forever in contact with them at that level anytime you instigate it, without sex.
Okay, got it. That's
it's like a super ESP, but it goes so far that the nervous systems have joined, but not as usually is thought, because it's like if you're rubbing and they're receiving, so there is some simultaneous there, but the linking of both systems is at an extremely high level, and that's the search for God consciousness was the phrase they used. Using the senses to search for God consciousness. And that was a no-no.
Okay, that's... I would just say that one of the breakthroughs, maybe post-Rye, of the late 60s and early 70s, was the retrieval and discovery of the use of your senses towards God consciousness.
Which, when we took acid, spilled out over the whole...
culture.
World.
Yeah.
In other words, it's not that it hadn't been around, but it's like because of what was happening and changes, then it was a massive spillage that popped up everywhere.
Reminds me of McLuhan's review of William Burroughs when he said the universe had an orgasm at the end of the 19th century. So this use of the word massive spillage sounds like a biological orgasm.
Yeah. But,
and that would be an effect of Rye returning to essence. You know, that would
well, except here's the thing that at the same time is when man reaches the point where he no longer is running from God, therefore, the significance of progeny isn't a factor anymore. Not that it's a no, or etc., but it's not a factor anymore. And man is looking to find out what he really is. And what he really is the disappearance of the cobwebs of Rye.
Yeah.
See, that's what the whole world is going through. And it's particularly keen right now as all these chaotic breakdowns in system after system after system, and while they're scrambling to resolve each of their sections, because they're separate, they don't know what everybody else is doing, and those who are aware are focusing energy so that as that mush happens in all those areas, that at some point a transformation occurs as a catalyst. And in, like with plastic, where you put a catalyst in, it's mushy for a while, and then it hardens again.
Yeah.
So we're between the hardening, mushiness, and the next hardening, which is the new form. But the old form is fond of recreating its form again and again. And this is where, maybe this is new being. You know, we've talked about it.
Yeah.
I haven't thought about it too much, but here I am looking at a possibility that may be what new being is. It may be the same thing as the Jesus freaks that talk about being born again, or being caught up in the clouds. It may be all the same thing with different connotations.
Is the new being, you mean the re-solidification or crystallization after the mush? Is that what you're saying?
That could be a version of it, yes.
Yeah, but I don't think it'll get too solid.
That's what I have always thought.
Yeah, Okay, so I want to move out of this, but I looked up, checked out some more on Baratti, and Time Magazine reviewed his book of 1976 called The Light at the Center. Looks like a very good review. Anybody's listening, Google Baratti and the Time Magazine review. It's interesting, in light of what went on at the center, the first paragraph in the review says, this is 1976, you know, 20 years later from when Baratti showed up. The reviewer says, let your fingers do the walking, and these days they stumble at almost every step over yoga parlors, Tai Chi ranches, Scientology centers, Subud temples, Sufi congregations.
Subud temples?
Yeah, you mentioned Subud. And they're the ones that took over from the center in 1960, but continuing here, Sufi congregations, transcendental meditation ashrams, Hare Krishna missions, Zen monasteries, astrology academies, and tarot prophets. The flyways from east to west are dense with flocks of migratory swamis who come bearing wisdom and go lugging gold.
What are you reading this from?
This is a review of, in Time Magazine of,
Of
Baratti's book.
In 76.
Yeah. And the book is called A Light at the Center, Context and Pretext of Modern Mysticism. They go, a bazaar of the bizarre, if ever there was one, and its most exotic merchandise, the pearl beyond price, is something known as Brahmacharyam, or Samadhi, or Marifat, or in plain English, the mystical experience.
Mm-hmm.
It says, it is an experience so rare that few are qualified to distinguish the false from the genuine article. What has long been needed is a global bureau of mystical standards.
Oh, God, you hit a nerve.
What?
You hit a nerve.
Yeah.
Because it's like I never liked the name Organization of Awareness for the same reason I just laughed.
Yeah.
And so when it came along with Servants of Awareness, I thought, you got to serve somebody. It might as well be awareness.
You're quoting the Dylan song? You know that song? You're aware of that, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
I said it with the same enunciation.
Yes, you're hip, Dave. You're 80 years old, but you keep tuned in.
Well, I wrote the script.
See, the two line of Xenocrony, David Eugene Worcester. Okay.
Genie.
Genie. Not a sub-genie.
No, a genie. That was my name.
They called you Genie as a kid?
From the time I was a child, I was called Genie.
Well, that's amazing. The Church of Subgenius, they call themselves Subgenies. So
I just got a rush.
Yeah,
anyway,
you wrote the script, Dave. That's the point here, right?
I just got a rush from that. But yes, when I was a child, in the first place, I didn't talk very quick, except for mommy and daddy and yes and no. But I had a cousin who was a teenager named Faith Hastings at the time. And she would take her finger and thump me on the head, my forehead. And she'd say, "Ouch, my bean." And wait. And she'd keep it up until after enough times I would finally say, "Ouch, my bean." So that's one of the first things that I learned. She went on to work at Menninger, you know, the top psychiatric. My mother was their housekeeper before I was born. She goes and works there.
Your mother was the housekeeper of the Menningers?
Yes.
Okay. What city is that? Where is that?
Topeka, Kansas.
Oh, okay.
It was the largest psychiatric unit in the world, and then, of course, all kinds of other things happened, but it's still big. Carl Menninger.
Yeah. But you were saying that you got clipped in the head in the forehead.
Yeah, and to get me to talk. And you see, my name was David Eugene Worcester, but some people called me Gene, but most of them in the earliest days called me Genie. So I was Genie. And I like to say that they would ask me to do something, and I would see if I could do it. And I kept doing that all the way through until I was 21, and then I realized I could say no. So I, in other words, all these adventures I went through mostly was because I didn't learn to say no.
Wow.
And then they, and then after they called me Genie, by the time I was going into school, I was Genie Boy.
Wait, now, are you saying, what's the phrase, ouch my genie?
Ouch my bean.
B-E-I-N-G, being?
B-E-A-N, I think, my bean, my head.
Ouch my head, but she'd say that. She said,
ouch my bean.
I see, like her head is her bean, right.
That my head.
Yeah, and she would do that to activate you to speak.
Yes,
yeah.
And so I, you know, as I look back and hearing some of these techniques that people have used to I must have been virtually autistic. Who knows?
Mm.
But they said that about Krishnamurti too.
Yeah, that's right. But it's like, but she's flicking your third eye,
Or a little to the right.
Yeah.
Or to my right.
Yes. Okay, but but you did get a rush when I said Church of the Subgenius and that they call themselves Subgenies. That you got a rush.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot you're a fool with all that.
Did you say fool?
Fooling with all that.
Fooling, yeah, okay.
Fooling without a G.
Yeah, right.
Fooling.
Yeah. Okay, it says, what has long been needed is a global bureau of mystical standards.
Or, this is a Times saying this.
Yeah, Time magazine. And it says, or at least an impartial spiritual assayer. You know, that's like the guy, the gold thing, right?
Right.
Or at least an impartial spiritual assayer who is thoroughly trained in both Eastern and Western traditions and values. Then he says, the right man may now have turned up. Son of a Hindu father. Oh, there's the Hindu connection. His father was Hindu.
Who?
They're saying Bharati's father was a Hindu.
No.
They got
no, his
wrong.
Father was a Lord. They're mixing it up with Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti's father was a theosophist Hindu.
Right. Well, maybe the father...
Anyway, go ahead.
But they go Hindu, they may mean his father was into Hinduism. Was a Hindu religion.
No, his father was into whores and polo and drinking and mistresses.
And wealth. I mean,
yeah, that was his whole lifestyle. His parents were, they didn't like what he was doing when he did it, but he did it without them knowing it, mostly.
The father? Yes.
Yeah, either one of them. They had their own worlds. They didn't even pay much attention to him, so he could do about anything he wanted as a kid.
Right, so it says, the right man may now have turned up to be the head of the Bureau of Mystical Standards. Son of a Hindu father and a German mother, Agananda Bharati grew up in between wars, Vienna. Studied in Indian monasteries and then took degrees in anthropology and philosophy at the University of Washington. They got that all screwed up.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Now, they're reviewing his book and he's alive?
Yeah, that's 1976. He's alive, yeah.
I wonder if they checked with him and he just let it go.
Yeah, this is Time magazine, you know. They're known to screw everything up, so...
Well, I know, but the point is, I think they check, and...
Well, maybe he did take degrees in anthropology and philosophy at the University of Washington, but that's years
he
after.
He wasn't there long enough to do that.
That's right, he's only there 1 year.
He was already credited all across the world.
Yeah, he was already...
But anyway, they had to do it that way. It's the same thing as some other shit, you know.
Yeah. But the thing is, you're right, he's only at the University of Washington 1 year, and then he goes to Syracuse. So they then say he is now chairman of the Department of Anthropology at Syracuse University. And then it goes on a long review, but I'm not going to read it, but that's the beginning. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. So back to Bob is discussing Krishnamurti with Agananda, and he says, Agananda says that... these mystical experiences are like sex or any other sense of joy that gave one a mystical feeling of being part of the all-knowing ground of being. What? And then Bob says that Agananda is saying what Krishnamurti says. And Krishnamurti says meditation is a nonsense practice or escape from the realities of the world. He then says he is a mystic. I don't know. This may be what Agananda is saying about Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti is a mystic, and mystics have experiences that are personal and are not to be taken as the goal for others to have. Then Bob asks him, did he believe that Krishnamurti had freed himself from the wheel of rebirth, that he was a liberated man? It's awkwardly written here. I cannot say. I don't know what this next sentence. He goes, did he believe that Krishnamurti had freed himself from the wheel of rebirth, that he was a liberated man? I cannot say. Oh, okay, so he's saying that he cannot say what Agananda said about that factor. For this was a subject of philosophy, not to be taken as some result or attainment. So he's saying he didn't get an opinion on Krishnamurti from Agananda, whether he freed himself from a wheel of rebirth, because it was treated, when discussing with Bharati, as philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Besides, you can't make a statement about somebody else's attainment.
Yeah, you cannot be taken as some result or attainment. Okay, you cannot judge that. He would discuss ideas about moksha as real or just a belief. Moksha, is that soma?
No, moksha is one of the things that he pointed out in relation to the Tantra, didn't he?
I don't know. M-O-K-S-H-A, what's that mean? What's the word referred to?
Let's see, how was it used?